kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. You want to sit down? Need something?
No, ma'am.
There's these two fellers. They're standing on a bridge. They're going to the bathroom. One feller says that the water is cold. Other feller said the water is deep. I believe one feller come from Arkansas. Get it?
Billy Bob Thornton's Carl from 1998's Sling Blade in that scene, understanding that joke about as well as two northern boys can claim to understand the South, which of course won't stop us from sharing this week's top five movies set in the South.
We're doing the top five in a southern accent, right?
Oh man, God help us.
Also on the show, Michael Phillips steps in for Adam to review one of the year's most acclaimed films, director Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, and the fifth film in our Korean auteur's marathon, Secret Sunshine. That and more.
The water's deep. I get it now.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1113.
We're also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For Film Spotting listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service, and we have two picks for you this week. One comes to us via listener Nigel in Tufnell Park, London. And yes, I do have to acknowledge once again Spinal Tap, Nigel in Tufnell Park. I think this movie's been mentioned on the show before, Josh, during one of these Audible segments. But since I haven't actually read the book, this means a lot more coming from Nigel or his wife, as the case is. We hear his comments via his wife, Jo.
Nigel says, my wife Jo is the Audible subscriber in our house, and she really recommended World War Z. I've read the book and think it's terrific, but the multiple narrator oral history format works brilliantly as an audiobook, apparently. I've yet to see the movie, and as far as I can tell, the film bears little relation to the book. I know Josh liked the movie, but broke his own rule by not having read the book, so perhaps Josh can catch up with an audio format. I'd like to know how he compares the two.
So you don't require yourself
read
the book,
it's
but
not a rule.
You do occasionally like to read the book before seeing the movie, something I abhor.
I might take Nigel up on this, though. I've heard good things about the book.
Okay, well, another book I've heard a lot of good things about, and it goes back to our discussion last week, our Sacred Cow review of The Exorcist. You can get the 40th anniversary unabridged edition by the author, William Peter Blatty. It's narrated by Blatty along with Eliana Shaskin, and I've never read The Exorcist, maybe because I think if I did read it or listen to it, it doesn't matter where I was or what time of day it was, I would start shuddering in fear like a five-year-old. So I may not be man enough to actually indulge in the Audible version of The Exorcist, but I am nevertheless going to put it out there for our listeners.
It's probably a case where the movie would still overwhelm your experience of an audiobook, I
maybe
would think.
Maybe so, but you know,
good for some people. Bad for others.
I do love, though, that's one of my big things, not to digress, but that's one of my big things, Josh, why I love seeing the movie first and then going to the book is because you know the movie is going to be, quote unquote, a watered down version of the book. You're always going to get so much more, so many more details, so much more information when you read the book. I like to add on to the experience. That's my argument anyway.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. You are listening to Film Spotting. You can call me Mr. Tibbs. Or, you know what, let's stick with Josh Larson. Later in the show, Adam Kempinar and I will share our top five movies about the South. We'll also continue our six-week look at contemporary Korean cinema with Lee Chang-dan's Secret Sunshine. But first, travel commitments kept Adam from seeing 12 Years a Slave in time for this week's review. But you know you're in a good place when your emergency backup is Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. Hello, Michael. Thanks for filling in.
Thank you. It's a stone-cold honor to be here.
Well, it's been only, what, a couple weeks since you were on to talk movie musical themes?
That's right.
Yeah, so that's fine. I'm sure listeners won't complain if you're back again early.
We had a lot of good feedback on that show.
We did, yeah. A lot of listeners responded to that, and I'm sure they won't mind having you on this early again. Let's get right to one of Film Spotting's most anticipated films of 2013, Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave.
I want to ask you what part of the country you come from.
I originate from Canada.
I guess where that is.
Well, I know where Canada is. I've been there myself.
We'll travel for a slave.
Solomon Northup is an expert player on the violin.
I was born a free man, lived with my family in New York.
Be good for your mother.
Until the day I was deceived.
To Solomon.
Kidnapped, sold into slavery.
Well, boy, how you feel now?
My name is Solomon Northup. I'm a free man.
And you have no right whatsoever to detain me.
You're no free man. You're nothing but a Georgia runaway.
When it was announced that British director Steve McQueen, who I consider one of the most exciting filmmakers at work today, was going to adapt 12 Years a Slave, I'll admit I was a little bit worried. After all, it was based on impeccably noble material, the 1853 memoir of Solomon Northup, a free Northern African American who was kidnapped and sold into slavery in the South. McQueen was also at the point in his career after two acclaimed art films, Hunger and Shame, when some other filmmakers have made a bid for mainstream acceptance. In other words, 12 Years a Slave offered the prospect of a unique talent being put into the service of an airless prestige picture. No such thing happened. In fact, McQueen succeeded, along with Chiwetel Ejiofor as Solomon and the rest of the ensemble cast, to such a degree that now, Michael, you and I have a challenge before us. How do we make this conversation interesting when both of us have such deep admiration for 12 Years a Slave? You gave it 4 stars in the Chicago Tribune. I gave it the same rating on my site. I saw that you mentioned in your mind it's McQueen's best film of the three. I'd agree with that. So unlike when Adam and I reviewed The Exorcist recently, we're not going to get into a spirited debate here. Perhaps for our discussion, we should go back to that notion of the prestige picture and argue together against those few critics. There have been a few who have accused 12 Years a Slave of being just that, safely packaged for well-meaning consumption. So in your mind, what was the most crucial element that kept the movie from being the sort of sterile, dutiful Oscar darling that we have seen before?
The real answer, I think, Josh, is that McQueen stuck to his guns stylistically while adjusting his, if you want to call it a style based on two previous features, adjusting it very, very shrewdly for telling this particular story. I can see why some people don't think it's a masterpiece and don't find its approach or technique compelling. It's a very kind of hands-off, dispassionate, and sort of scrupulously artful approach to movie storytelling. I mean, you got it with Hunger, the Bobby Sands Hunger Strike movie he did the first up. You got it in spades with the fictional story Shame, about a sex addict played by Michael Fassbender, who's been in McQueen's all three of his features so far, where it's the atmosphere is so sort of tight and patient at the same time that it makes some people a little itchy, and you don't go to a McQueen film, I think, for a roiling sense of documentary real life. That's not what he's about. He is a filmmaker with a really distinct and rigorous style, and it's not for everybody. But I'll tell you, it's why this film, 12 Years a Slave, I think works, because the material, as you say, is so inherently kind of powerful, and if it's not handled right, sort of insufferably well-meaning and noble, because it deals with one of the great American shames of the age, slavery. You worry that it's all going to turn into a bunch of placards and not so much characters, but just points of view or cogs in a wheel, all that. This picture is not like that. It doesn't have that sort of heft of a typical movie epic. It doesn't have scenes with a lot of, you know, with hundreds of extras. It doesn't have a lot of digital replication of hundreds of extras.
There's an intimate scale here.
Very,
to
and
that, it. Yeah.
That's why it works. I really believe that. And when you are stuck in the movie's adaptation of the Northup memoir, which is amazing reading, and it was a great excuse to read it finally. You're really kind of boiling this movie down to two plantation experiences out of what was in true in real life, many different sort of transitions for Northup. But you really get every inch of the socioeconomic life and the kind of venality of these plantation sort of landscapes. And again, we'll talk about this in a bit, but I mean, he is so shrewd about the value of sustaining a long take so that you are not allowed to look away in certain very painful things. You're not allowed to move on to the next scene or get the obvious emotional cueing of some sort of reaction shot. You are just simply there with Chiwetel Ejiofor as Solomon Northup, observing everything, watching everything, and it's happening to him, but he's also outside his own narrative. And that duality is what gives the film just a unique perspective, I think.
Yeah, it is his story, but he's an observer in a lot of ways, right, too. And I think, you know, it's very artful. He's not at a distance. Sometimes he's accused of being at a distance from his stories. McQueen is as a director. I don't feel that there's this distance here that's harmful because he's artful without being inflated, which is what a prestige picture might be. And right, that gets to everything from the extras you're talking about, where we need to just make the movie itself physically bigger.
Right.
But also that can be an approach as well. So I did appreciate that about it, the way McQueen handled it that way. And really what struck out to me with a distinguishing feature is that this is a movie that throws its subject matter back at the audience, is how I took it, where some prestige pictures on terrible topics like this, there's an element of pride, probably isn't the right word, but accomplishment that the movie has even been made and that we're all watching it and acknowledging it. And I feel like 12 Years a Slave plays with that a little bit in that it's not going to let us feel like we've accomplished anything by simply watching the movie. And one technique in particular made this work for me. And you see it in the very first scene, I think, because the first scene is remarkable. It's another long take of a group of slaves standing in a sugarcane field, I believe. They're very bedraggled, yet there's this resolute look in their eyes, and they're looking right at the camera. So right away, they're acknowledging us as the audience, and we have a different relationship with this film, it feels like to me, than many other historical epics. And this is a technique that pops up a few other times in the film, most notably, I think, when Ejiofor is scanning the landscape, and there are a lot of shots just holding his face. We should talk about his performance because I think it's interesting in a couple ways and maybe written off in some circles in a way that really works. But this shot is another one of his face, and he just scans across the screen and comes to another rest looking right at us. Mm-hmm. So this gets back to what I was saying about him being the story is about him, but he's also an observer because he witnesses so much horror that he can do nothing about. This is a movie about witnesses, about watching, and it does turn the audience. It turns us into witnesses too at the end and puts a burden on this.
Yeah.
So in some way that made me appreciate it more than a more noble-minded prestige picture.
Right, and maybe it's a matter of money. If he had $80 million instead of whatever he had, I don't know, 20 or something, or you know, to make it, would he have been tempted down that direction? You know, who knows? But there are trappings here and there of what you're talking about. I think when you have Hans Zimmer doing your musical score, you're risking certainly mm-hmm. a kind of Hollywood sound that may or may not wreck your intentions. As it happens, not one of my favorite composers, certainly one of his more astute efforts, I think so.
Think about a Johnny Greenwood score with this film or something like that.
Well,
That might have really fit McQueen a little bit more in a lot of ways.
Exactly. But McQueen, just as an artist, he is not trying to, primarily as an artist, he's not trying to make you cry. And that's just put you through the mill in the usual melodramatic ways. There is so much inherent anguished melodrama in Northup's story. It's almost like a dare. Look, we know the facts and the events of this man's life you're about to witness are so intense that I'm going to kind of dare you, he's saying, I think, to watch it and experience it a different way. We're going to kind of take a step back. We're going to show you we're not going to play it for just kind of really gut grinding revenge impulses. I mean, you can go to Django Unchained for that if you want. But this is kind of not just higher minded, but it's really just smarter and, you know, it's less sentimental and it's a little less about the gut and a little more about the head and the heart. And I think we're not used to seeing that, Josh, with any story that has anything to do with the American slavery experience.
I thought I told you to commence to putting on clappers.
Yes, master, I'm about it. These have all been replaced.
When didn't I tell you to get a keg of nails?
And so I did.
So you did. God damn you, I thought you knowed something.
I did as instructed. If there's something wrong, it's wrong with the instruction.
Black bastard. You goddamn black bastard. Strip your clothes. Strip.
I will not.
So let's get to some of the performances, because as we mentioned, it is an ensemble cast. A lot of very talented actors and actresses at work here, and we should probably start with Edgy Afford. And at first glance, it struck me as quite a stoic performance. You weren't quite sure, especially once. There's a lot of personality to Solomon at the start, where we see him with his family and engaging with the people who hire him to come from upstate New York to Washington, D.C., where he is eventually kidnapped. But once he falls under the machinery of slavery, and that's very much what the picture depicts it as, a machine, he becomes quite stoic, understandably, to the point where you may feel like you're at a remove from him. Mm. But I do feel that's intentional, because I think it goes back to this idea of him being an observer. And there's a double tragedy. It's not only the suffering that's going on underneath slavery, and this goes back to the witnessing theme as well, but the fact that others are forced to watch it helplessly throughout the film. In almost every scene we get of someone suffering in some way, there's another person in that scene who's forced to watch it and either pretend like it's not happening or ignore it or in some awful points assist in it. And at that point, Edgy Afford's performance is key to me, because he's expressing that helplessness that's key to the man's experience.
Edgy Afford is great. And it's not the kind of performance that you're going to get when you go to, say, on the other side of the slavery equation, Daniel Day-Lewis's Abe Lincoln, where it's all thundering oratory and beautifully and naturalistically rendered oratory, but it's different. He's a behavioral genius, this guy Edgy Afford. I've always liked him. One of my favorite contemporary actors, and it's just a kind of mixture of cerebral insight and really clean, honest, emotional truth as an actor that it's great technique, married to just the right amount of feeling. And you get that with all the performances, I think. Everybody from Lupita Nyong'o, who plays Patsy, one of the other slaves, who's kind of the favorite of the vicious slave master played by Michael Fassbender. I mean, she's straight out of Yale, a fantastic young actress.
It's an amazing performance. The best in the film, I think, actually.
Do you think so? Yeah. No, that she's just marvelous. And these actors are dealing with period language really shrewdly kind of captured by the adapter John Ridley, and straight out of the memoir in many ways, but it is very much a period picture, as it should be. It doesn't have kind of a contemporary sound or ring to it. The contemporary touches, I think, aren't so much in the acting, but just really in kind of McQueen's that slightly stylized remove, and I don't think it's a bad thing to say the picture has that sort of stance. That feels somewhat contemporary and very much a modern artist looking back at another time and a horrible situation. It's not the same as You Are There. This is how I imagined it might have seemed to me had I been forced to watch it all. But the performances are great. Fassbender's great. The only one that really threw me out of the movie, frankly, Josh, is Brad Pitt, who was one of the producers. The movie wouldn't have been made without Brad Pitt. Pitt's fine, but I don't know. You're rolling along fully in the story, and then, hey, it's Brad Pitt, you know, holding a hammer. There are other well-known and recognizable actors in this thing. Paul Dano, Paul Giamatti, you know, Alfred Woodward shows up for one scene. I think they're just famous enough to not throw you out of the narrative. And it's not Pitt's fault that he's as famous as he is. But if he were like a tiny bit better an actor, I wouldn't have had the problem. What about you?
I do want to get to Pitt, because I think it's a very interesting piece of the film. You're listening to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips sitting in for Adam Kempinar. I'm Josh Larson. And it struck me as far as Pitt goes, and I generally like him as an actor than most, I find. But it struck me that it was more of a problem with the screenplay at that point. And I'm glad you brought up Woodard as well, because I think her scene suffers similarly. And maybe there's something to what you're saying, because they both are recognizable actors. But in both instances, they were the only times I felt we were getting a little bit of speechifying in 12 Years a Slave, rather than a movie that for 99.9% of its time communicates through imagery and sound. In Pitt's scene and Woodard's scene, they're dialogue sequences where one person is espousing an opinion, and they are interesting actors, but the words in Ridley's script here seem to weigh them down a little bit. I think for me, at least, that's why those scenes stood out more than the performances themselves.
Take comfort, Patsy. Good Lord will manage apps. In his own time, good Lord will manage them all. The curse of the pharaohs brought a poor example of what waits for the plantation class.
Yeah, I see the point. I think it's the opposite, really, of something you're going to get with Tony Kushner's script for Lincoln, where it's just one big, juicy sort of, you know, ham sandwich for an actor after another.
That's how everyone's talking in that film, right?
Yeah. Now, here, I think the best of the, when you see Paul Giamatti, who's a very familiar character actor, and he's a guy like many lucky actors in Hollywood who risk overexposure at this point. We've seen Paul Dano, Paul Giamatti, a lot of these character folk in all kinds of parts. We see him in some years in many movies in one year. But Giamatti's scene, it's one scene as a slave trader in New Orleans, I believe. And he's the anchor of a really stunning long take that has a lot of complicated action and camera movement sort of working together to give you this sense of what it would have been like to witness a, you know, just, okay, here's the latest shipment. I really suggest this one's worth every penny of the 600 I'm asking for the following reasons. And it's a really deeply uncomfortable scene, but handled with this great forthright, sort of swift, matter-of-fact, brio by Giamatti. It's not an actor showboating at all. It's an actor just completely serving the material and the situation. And you never lose sight of Edufor's role in it all. That's why I think the movie succeeds, honestly, Josh. It's just that it gives you a panoramic sense of what the institution and the economics of slavery meant to the individuals, and you're seeing it through the eyes of one individual, but it's not at the expense of everybody else who might have been in that same room, on that same plantation, and you get a real sense of interacting. And look, this is honestly one of the few movies I've seen that had anything to do with slavery, or really any deeply uncomfortable slice of American history, where you had a natural, easy breathing and yet profoundly uncomfortable mixture of black characters and white characters, because it's the only way to tell this thing. So often you get crap like Mississippi Burning, you know, the Alan Parker melodrama that was all about the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And I mean, the African-American characters in that, they hardly have lines. It's all about the ass-kicking white FBI agents, Gene Hackman, and basically winning the day. And this film, conversely, doesn't do the dramatically tidy thing of marginalizing the white characters. We have, you know, big, vital, frightening, you know, white characters interacting as they did with Solomon Northup's life, but the proportions are just right. McQueen knows who to stick the story, you know, front and center, and where to put the camera in relation to that character, Solomon Northup.
You mentioned how it captures slavery as an institution, and I think that's exactly right, even though it is a personal story. And one way it does that is by depicting at once in single scenes, the Giamatti scene is an example of this, both nonchalance and horror just sitting side by side. And there are other moments, probably the one that will stick with most people who have seen this film, I know it did for me, is where Solomon at one point is tied by his neck up to a tree branch and left there. This is a form of punishment. He's left there just enough ground space underneath him so that he won't hang. But the mud there that he's in is very squishy, so his toes are constantly moving around. And this is another long take, one of those that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And what struck me about it is, again, the background. In the background, you will see other slaves who are walking by and not even looking. Maybe this is the one. There are other scenes that work similarly, but this might also be the one where there are children, slave children, giggling and playing in the background. And
there
what,
is in one
what
shot,
that
yeah.
captures and communicates is just that this has become such an institutionalized awfulness that its very victims, at least some of them, have begun to take it for granted.
Right.
And you just feel that bear down on you and get thrown back at you by the film.
And that's what makes it very hard for some people to even just get through, because it doesn't give
Understandably.
It doesn't give you the conventional sort of Hollywood release sort of feelings of release, or it doesn't give you the anachronistic.
Yet I didn't find any of that manipulative. Did you?
No,
where it was really going for it and trying to get you with it. It was, and here's where I think McQueen's sense of distance is a plus.
Yes, absolutely. No, I agree. I agree. The only thing that hit me the first time I saw Josh, where it really felt like this isn't quite right, were the early scenes set in Saratoga in 1841 or 42, wherever it is, where, you know, we see Northup and his family and as free men and women of color up north, way north of the Mason-Dixon line. And you get a sense that in these few scenes, those are painted a little more broadly in that it's a bit of a fairy tale.
You maybe see, idealized a
you,
bit.
You see absolutely no hint of any racial tension in Northrop's life at all, anywhere in his life in Saratoga. And even just reading a bit of the Saratoga sections of the memoir and other people writing about the memoir, life wasn't entirely that smooth for Northrop before what happened to him happened to him. And I wish the film had sort of acknowledged that. It just feels like an easy contrast of the fairy tale, idyllic, democratic life up north and then all the miseries and injustices that happened to him later. I think for contrast's sake, it's God knows it's effective. That to me felt it's like the one toe this movie has in old Hollywood.
So a few quibbles here, but just a few regarding
a few,
12 Years a Slave. The movie is currently in limited release. It will be expanding. However, if you agree or disagree with Michael and my take, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Thanks again, Michael. Really appreciate your sitting in. And I'm assuming listeners could read your full print review of the film at chicagotribune.com/movies?
Yes, they can.
All right. Excellent.
Okay.
We're going to let Michael off the hook for Massacre Theater. Adam will be back for that when we return. And we'll definitely make Adam sit through a bunch of Brad Pitt praise as we reveal the results of the film spotting poll, asking what is Pitt's best supporting performance. Stay with us.
Satellite's gone up to the skies. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Satellite of love. Satellite's gone way up to Mars. Soon it'll be filled with park and cars. I watched it for a little while. I love to watch things on TV.
Everyone, brief interruption here for a reminder that Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
We're also brought to you once again by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. I do like to pick a topic that ties in with whatever we're discussing on this week's show. Go over to Shutterstock and see what they have available clip-wise. And if you go and look at their footage and you type in just Southern, you get over 9,000 video clips that come up. Southern food, Josh. Southern food, which I know is going to factor into your top five list. 156
right.
Different clips, some in HD, some in standard def. They source video clips from all around the world and put them at your fingertips. Many of their contributors are professional filmmakers, and they make it really easy. They've got sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category or clip resolution, contributor name, and a whole lot more. They also have flexible pricing. You can choose between just the individual clip that you want, or if you need a whole lot of Southern food clips, you can get a video pack.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. And then save your video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1113 and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com. And for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM1113. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I suppose you have homework to do.
You have no idea how boring everything was before I met you.
action is character, our English teacher says. I think it means that if we never did anything, we wouldn't be anybody. And I never did anything before I met you. And sometimes I think no one's ever done anything in this whole stupid country, apart from you.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I am Adam Kempinar. Josh actually did unlock the studio and let me back in after the pros got to review 12 Years a Slave.
We needed you for Massacre Theater.
That's right. My acting chops were definitely needed here. Before we get to that, that was a scene, of course, from the great movie from 2009, a movie that was among my top 10 of the year, An Education. Carey Mulligan as Jenny and Peter Sarsgaard as David. It is, Josh, one of those coming-of-age movies. And with Blue is the Warmest Color, new film coming out here in Chicago next weekend, a Palme d'Or winner, a film I think you could call, among other things, a coming-of-age movie.
Sounds like it.
That's going to set up our poll question, which we'll get to a bit later in the show. But right now, it is time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
What do you think, Jack? You think if you pick up all the bus driver's teeth, they'll give you another medal? Jeez. You think I wouldn't have been prepared? 2 years I spent setting up that elevator job. 2 years I invested myself in it. You couldn't understand the kind of commitment that I have. You were in a man's life's work, and you think you can walk away. You got blinders on to the world. But I got your attention now, didn't I, Jack?
Why didn't you just come after me?
No, this is about me. This is about my money. This is about money due me, which I will collect. $3.7 million. It's my nest egg, Jack. At my age, you've got to think ahead.
That was Keanu Reeves as Jack Traven and Dennis Hopper as Howard Payne in Speed from 1994. Speed was written by Graham Yost, directed by Jan de Bont. It was actually his debut film, mostly known as a cinematographer before that. Do you know what his last film was as a director?
I do not.
2003's Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. That would be the sequel, I think.
Yeah, I did see the original. I remember having to write a review of that film, directed by Simon West.
Okay, that
sounds
right.
The great Simon West,
yes.
I believe, of Con Air fame.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I think, Josh, that was my first year of ever writing newspaper reviews, and I gave it my first zero-star review.
You
the
came
original.
Right out of the gate, your
well,
first year with a zero-star
yeah,
review,
I was,
huh? You knew this was a zero-star review.
Yeah, I was about 6 months into the gig, and I finally just had to unleash the zero-star review. But that was not a slight on Jan de Bont. I'm sure Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life is a masterpiece. The tie-in, of course, to our last show was top five hostage movies, tying in with our discussion of the new Tom Hanks film, Captain Phillips. And if you want to hear our discussion of Captain Phillips or our top five list, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, why don't you reach into the hat? It is much more brimming than
good.
In recent weeks. Finally, a lot of listeners, you know, that was right in our demographics wheelhouse, I think, Speed.
Mm-hmm.
Just in terms of year-wise,
right.
I think we have a lot of listeners in that age group. So reach into the brimming Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Peter Boyd from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Congratulations, Peter. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays.
The show must go on.
No, dear. Margot must go on.
Time now for Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information is at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
And we do have a couple of recommendations for you if you are going over to Fandor.com/filmspotting to check out what they have. November highlights, Josh, in front of me, 1965's Meet Marlon Brando. And I'm really excited about this, not necessarily because I'm the biggest Marlon Brando fan in the world, though, like everyone else, I am a fan. But this is the first time this movie is available to be seen anywhere since its theatrical release in 1965. It's a documentary by the Maisels brothers. And I studied the Maisels a lot as I was teaching my Cinema Verite course at the University of Chicago's Graham School a couple summers ago. And I read a lot about this film and some of their earlier films like this. They also did a profile of Jane Fonda, if I recall correctly, but couldn't find them anywhere. Couldn't get them on DVD. So the fact that this is out is something that's really exciting to me.
Another hard-to-find documentary is going to be on Fandor coming up November 19th. It actually happens to be probably my favorite movie of the year, still jostling for that spot.
Spoiler
Leviathan.
Alert.
Yeah, well, we'll see. 12 Years a Slave, it's inching in that territory too.
Wow.
So we'll see where things do shake out. But Leviathan has been really hard to find. It showed up at a lot of festivals last year, but smaller fests, and then it was trickling around here and there. Fandor's going to have it. This is an experimental, immersive documentary set on a commercial fishing boat. That's just one of the more unique experiences at a movie I've had.
And that will be available on Fandor November 19th. November 15th is the date for Meet Marlon Brando. Let's get now to this week's scene. I am really excited about this one, Josh. And I have to admit, I'm shocked that in 465 shows, 8.5 years of film spotting, we've never done this movie.
That
I'm surprised.
Is surprising.
Yeah.
And this is the best scene to do. This is the one you've wanted to do.
Well, Candace, our wonderful associate producer, pulled 3 or 4 scenes, and this was the slam
dunk. Just jumped right out.
Well, our listeners, I think, really love it when things get a little awkward in the studio.
Just in
between
general.
Us.
Not
yeah.
only in Massacre Theater.
Right. But especially during scenes like this in Massacre Theater. So it does tie in with our top 5 this week. We'll give you that much. Movies set in the South. We'll see if you guys can come up with some other fun connections or not. That's all we got. It's a movie set in the South. You're going to start it off, so I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
All right, let's go.
And action.
You're playing with my mind.
I'm trying to play with your body.
I knew it. You're trying to seduce me.
Well, of course I'm trying to seduce you, for God's sake, and I'm doing a damn poor job of it. Aren't I pretty?
God, I think you're real cute.
Cute? Baby ducks are cute. I hate cute. I want to be exotic and mysterious.
You are. You're exotic and mysterious and cute. And that's why I'd better leave.
And scene.
Can I go now?
You can go now. Please. Please exit the door. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, November 4th.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
See you, bud. You how you saw it. Hey, look. It helped as much I'm going to hit. You still got a car. I suggest you use it, for you're not welcome anymore.
I think
you should fuck off now, but you still got the legs to carry you.
Nobody
brings a fella the size of you unless they're trying to say something without talking, right, bye?
Sorry, Mickey. Just give us our money back and you can keep your caravan.
Why the fuck do I want a caravan? It's got no fucking wheels.
Josh, we go from perfect elocution there in that Massacre mm-hmm. Theater scene to not so perfect elocution, but that's what the role required, or at least that's what the performer decided the role required there in that scene from Guy Ritchie's film Snatch from 2000. Brad Pitt, yes, nearly indecipherable as Mickey in that film, and yet we had to bleep it anyway. So I guess he is a little bit
sure.
decipherable. And that gets us into our poll results from last week as we were looking ahead to 12 Years a Slave, where Brad Pitt, I'm told, I haven't seen the movie yet, does play a supporting character. So with that in mind, he has turned out a few very notable supporting performances over the course of his career. We wanted to know which one you thought was the most notable or the best. And with 1,000 votes cast, over 1,000 votes cast at filmspotting.net, we're going to say this is the definitive answer.
Yes.
Unless I completely disagree with it, which is actually the case. Your options for best supporting role from Brad Pitt are Dick Ritchie's stoner roommate Floyd in True Romance, Jeffrey Goines from 12 Monkeys, Chad Feldheimer in Burn After Reading, Lieutenant Aldo Rain from Inglourious Basterds, Killing Nazis, and Mr. O'Brien from The Tree of Life. Josh, how did it come out?
I think this is the second time that True Romance has not fared very well in a poll recently.
Which is shocking.
Yeah, the 1993 movies. It didn't do too well either here. Last place, 8%. Chad Feldheimer, my pick, is in second to last place with 19%. Lieutenant Aldo Rain right there in the middle, 22%. Mr. O'Brien gets 25% of the vote and squeaking out the win with 26% is Jeffrey Goines, your favorite Pitt performance, Adam.
Man, I think it's actually, as I said, my second least favorite
Pitt
performance.
After California.
Yeah, after California, which 5 people watched that movie and I kind of wish I hadn't. But Jeffrey Goines, there it is. He did get a Best Supporting Actor nomination, as I recall. And I like that movie enough, but that performance does drive me crazy. And Jason Mahan, a listener, knows that. He says, I know that this will just irk Adam to no end, as this is Brad Pitt at his absolute pittiest, but my vote has to go with 12 Monkeys. This performance was to me the lone bright spot in a very dour and depressing, but ultimately fascinating movie. His energetic and extremely entertaining, why have one facial tick when you can have 10 performance, ultimately captured my attention and carried me through the movie. Sorry, Adam.
Hey, if you're going to have 10 facial ticks, it might as well be in a Terry Gilliam movie. I think that just sort of seems to fit.
True.
Aaron Teachman in Washington, D.C. actually agreed with me. Josh, my man, I'm absolutely with you on this one. I'm voting for Burn After Reading. Pitt's supporting roles have a tendency towards scenery-chewing bombast that don't always fit into the film. 12 Monkeys is a case in point.
Thank you, Aaron.
Pitt's goofy turn in Burn After Reading is bombastic, but it is also of a piece with the film itself. Chad is Burn After Reading's spirit animal. It's a satire about bloviated self-importance mixed with epic cluelessness and the horrifying consequences that can result from the combination, and that is Chad all over. As an aside, I love that we have been talking about True Romance so much recently. I just freaking love that film.
We also heard from Will from nowhere, apparently. He says, Josh Larson, your comment about how Pitt isn't essential to Tree of Life has to top the list of, quote, crazy things Josh Larson has said.
Oh, boy.
Actually, on our 500th episode, which is going to be a big live blowout, hopefully next summer, I think we're just going to devote the whole show to crazy
category?
Things Josh Larson has said.
I better get working.
We can fill 2-3 hours with that minimum. Will goes on, the performance makes the character frightening, despicable, heartwarming, loving, and sympathetic all at the same time. I haven't seen a father character so complex before. I would call his performance in The Tree of Life not only his best supporting performance, but his best performance, period. And Will is correct on all counts, Josh.
Do you know that when they use your full name, you're really in trouble?
Yeah,
it's just like
your mother.
Teacher or your parents saying Josh Larson. I got an email or something about this too. That probably wasn't the best choice of words. What I meant to imply there is that when I think of Tree of Life and what's so great about that great film, Brad Pitt is not at the top of the list, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So that was not to say he gave a bad performance.
No.
Or that I didn't like it at all. But if you're asking what supporting performance do I think he's best at, I'm sticking with Chad Feldheimer.
Okay, well, I still go back to his performance in Moneyball, where I think that might be overall his best performance, but his best supporting turn is, for me, The Tree of Life. And that is what I think of.
Brad Pitt first?
Well, you know what, Josh? When I first think of Tree of Life, you say The Tree of Life, I go to that imagery, right? No doubt you go to the imagery, the yard, the shots of the sky, the kids playing. But my next thought is the kids playing with their father and that look on their father's face.
I think that's the next thing I see. Baby's foot before I think of Brad Pitt.
Well, that was on the poster, so that's a cop-out.
Maybe.
The last comment here from William Wrecker. I don't think he uses either of our full names.
Well, I voted for Chad Feldheimer from Burn After Reading. I am shocked and amazed that Mickey O'Neill from Snatch was left off the list. Mickey O'Neill is such an amazing character because he is able to single-handedly lift Snatch from a good film to a great film, and he does it solely through Pitt's performance. His ridiculous accent and his wink at the audience presence on the screen is the whole reason people recommended that film to their friends.
Yeah, and William was among many film spotting listeners who wrote in saying, how could you leave off Mickey from Guy Ritchie's Snatch? And, you know, I do like that film, haven't seen it since it came out, and I like his performance. That's one of those kooky, really nutty Brad Pitt performances that is, as William said, way over the top, and yet somehow works for that over-the-top film. I'm not surprised so many listeners did chime in with it. That brings us to this week's poll question. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and participate. Blue is the Warmest Color coming out, a film, as we said, Palme d'Or winner, opening in Chicago this weekend, and it is a film about two young teenage girls. So for the sake of our poll question, Josh, we're calling it a coming-of-age movie, and this is one of those classic Sam Van Halgren producer produced poll questions that I think is really going to generate some great responses from our listeners. And it's really more about them and getting personal than it is about the movies, which are the best questions. So we are posing this challenge to you. Which coming-of-age movie do you most relate to? In other words, finish this sentence. The only person who understood you was
a charming outcast. And here we're thinking of Say Anything or perhaps Edward Scissorhands. A dangerous outcast. So someone like Badlands, Heathers. Someone who was too old for you, Harold and Maude, and Education would fit in this category. How about your teacher or mentor? Dead Poets Society, Almost Famous come to mind here. The only person who understood you was your weird best friend, as in Pretty in Pink or Superbad. How about nobody? If you didn't have anyone, maybe like 400 Blows, Welcome to the Dollhouse. And one more choice here. The only person who understood you was Natalie Portman. Unfortunately, this is for Zach Braff.
He's the only one who can vote. One vote. It can't get any more.
He better vote.
Yeah. Of course, thinking of that film, Garden State. So, Josh, lots of options there. I don't know if there is one necessarily that really pinpoints your childhood. I mean, I know you a little bit now, and knowing your wife Debbie and how old you were when you met, a dangerous outcast is your obvious answer, right? I mean, Debbie
yes,
was
she was
really a rebel, and she scared
out
your
of
parents.
Control. Yeah. Yes, although that would super bad really more. It was like super bad actually with her in high school. So
okay.
I'll go with that.
Fair enough. That's where you're going. Is that your true answer?
You know what? It's not our anniversary. Valentine's Day is a long ways away, but I would have to say Debbie Grunewald for Josh Larson only. We didn't really see Garden State together.
We didn't see Garden State.
No, but I, you know, that's where I'd have to go.
Okay, you had
we
just
dated
that
in
one.
High school.
Yeah,
I mean,
I know.
It was, you know.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, I have no idea how that goes. This was hard for me, Josh. I have to admit, there wasn't one that really fit, and I'm not sure there still is one that would fit. But I'm probably gonna go. I'm probably gonna go teacher slash mentor. I had an English teacher in high school that,
okay,
I really looked up to and helped really shape the nerd who is sitting here on the mic today talking about movies and reading a lot of books and being an English major. So without him, I probably wouldn't be doing it. So Almost Famous and Dead Poets Society, a little closer.
I probably have a couple people like that who right now are shaking their fists saying, why didn't you
have forsaken
me?
Well, we think it's a fun poll question anyway. We want to hear your responses. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, we have some free movie passes to give away, and we have two movies here that have been mentioned recently on the show in most anticipated terms. The movie Dallas Buyers Club, starring my new favorite actor, Matthew McConaughey. It opens November 8th in Chicago, and on November 7th, so that Thursday night, they're going to have a free screening. We have passes to that screening. All you got to do is go to filmspotting.net and click on the link in the top stories. Also there in the top stories, you'll find a link to enter to win an Admit 2 pass to see any showing of How I Live Now. This is the new movie from Kevin MacDonald. It played at the Chicago Film Festival. I singled it out in my Chicago Film Fest preview because I like Kevin MacDonald's work and Saoirse Ronan as well, the lead actress in it. Unfortunately, we did recently get an email, Josh, a pretty scathing email from a longtime listener who said, I've seen How I Live Now and it's horrible.
Uh-oh.
But you know what? I'm still holding out hope.
It's only one person.
It is only one person, and that as well is opening here in Chicago on November 8th. And if you do win one of these Admit 2 passes, you can go see it during its run here in Chicago. So again, just go to filmspotting.net if you're one of our local Chicago listeners and do want to enter to get those free passes. Also at our website, that's where you can find out information about our bonus content. Most weeks here on the show, we do a little extra bit of audio that you can get if you have the Film Spotting iPhone app or Android app or Windows 8 phone app. And this week, when you and Michael kick me out of here.
Mm-hmm.
You guys did do a little bit of bonus as well. Do you want to share with our audience what they'll hear if they get that bonus content?
Yeah, he threw out a couple titles for our top five movies set in the South list. Had some good suggestions there. And actually, you might not want to listen to this part,
I'm
Adam.
I'm terrified. I knew this was going to happen.
We threw out there The Exorcist. We recently
and
did a Sacred
Team
Cow
Josh,
review.
Let me guess.
He might have been even a little more harsh than I was.
Come
The
on.
Exorcist. Sorry.
Come on, Michael. Never coming back on the show. Never.
You don't want to do that
back.
Over The Exorcist. There's far more important films.
I do, actually. I do, actually. How dare you, Michael? If you do want to hear Michael, another voice here on the show, taking down The Exorcist, I don't know why you would want to hear that. But if you do, again, that bonus content's available. Just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps for all the details. So before we get to Secret Sunshine, Josh, I did want to mention this story because it was something I know I've told you about and I shared with everyone else who helps out on the show, Sam and Joe and Candace. But I had an experience a few weeks ago where I was asked to be a judge at the Chicago Film Festival in the category of city and state. So there were 8 or 9 films that had Chicago or state of Illinois connections. Either the filmmakers were from there or they were shot here. And we had a great deliberation, met a couple of judges I didn't know before, and we had a great dinner and debated the films and came up with our winner. And then a few weeks ago on a Friday night, we were invited, me and one of the other jurors, to go up on stage and announce the winner. And we were the second award, okay? So we're pretty early into the night. They didn't say where we were from, Film Spotting, anything like that. They just said our names. We went up there, handed out our award, and then the next award happened to be Best Animated Film. And the winner went to a movie called Yellow Fever. And the director, who I'm sure I'm going to do great damage to by trying to pronounce her name, but it's Negendo Muki. She came up on stage, accepted her award. She's from Kenya. The movie is an African film. She explained that she was obviously grateful to win. And then she said, you know, I've been following the festival for a few years now. This is a great honor. I've been listening to Film Spotting for several years, all the way from Nairobi. And the crowd applauded. And just to have that moment where she looked over at me, she clearly heard my name and saw me and has been a longtime listener of the show. And for her to mention the show during her acceptance speech was pretty remarkable. I mean, someone from Nairobi,
right.
And I know we have listeners from all over the world and we hear from them a lot, but it was still one of those moments that really just kind of took your breath away.
You know what we need on the website or somewhere is a map and start. You know, they have those pin maps of
I
where
do.
People have traveled. We
yeah.
need one of where listeners are, because I think it'd be pretty amazing to see that.
I agree.
That.
I agree. And about 5 or 6 years ago, there was something like that floating out there. And I think it just kind of disappeared. But you're right. I'd love to find a good website that allows us to do that. The film, I should say, is a 7-minute film. And after finally getting a chance to watch it I totally understand. I don't even need to see the other films. And I'm not just saying this because she's a film spotting listener. It's a really, really good film. It's a movie about African girls, African women, and how they perceive themselves as African women, particularly in terms of their skin color. An appropriate show, probably, in light of 12 Years a Slave and thinking about race in particular. It made me think a lot of Good Hair, the Chris Rock film, and how you see in this 7-minute short film, which is rotoscope. The animation's amazing. It looks kind of like one of those Linklater movies, but it really does deal head on with the fact. And I didn't really know this. The title Yellow Fever comes from the idea that there are a lot of young women and even older women in Africa who have this compulsion to try to make themselves as white looking as possible. And they'll do whatever they can with their hair or face or skin to try to make themselves whiter. And that's where the yellow comes from. So it's a really remarkable film, and congratulations to Negendo, and thank you very much for listening to the show. Really do appreciate it. We get to the fifth and penultimate film in our Korean auteurs marathon with a scene there from Secret Sunshine featuring the lead actress Jeon Do-yeon as Lee Shin-ai. She's applauding with great vigor her young son Jun's speech before his class, a speech in which he talks of growing big and strong one day and being an upstanding Korean citizen. Josh, will he grow up to be big and strong, Josh? Will he?
You want me?
No, I don't.
To answer that question?
I'm mainly kidding, because I'm going to get into the subject matter here a little bit. It's by now well established I like to go into movies with as blank a slate as possible. And that even applies to our marathon movies, which is, of course, tough because we have to be the ones who ultimately decide which movies to include and which to exclude. How do you do that without paying some attention to the plot? Well, the answer is you mainly let other people do the work for you. In this case, we had hundreds of commenters on Letterboxd who chimed in with their thoughts on which Korean films we should watch. We had a summer intern, Brian Bielak, who watched many of them. He weighed in with his choices, and we strongly considered his advice. So all I knew about Secret Sunshine when we picked it for the marathon was that it was directed by Lee Chang-dong. I knew he was one of South Korea's preeminent filmmakers. I knew that he made the film Poetry from a few years back, a very good film. I think it was Michael Phillips' number one of that year. And many listeners said you had to include something by Lee, either Poetry or Secret Sunshine. Okay, done. Well, then you actually have to watch and discuss the movie, and I'm planning out my weekend, and I'm preparing for the show, and I go to Netflix to see the running time, and it's 142 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's long. I can prepare myself for that.
We started it late in the night, too.
We did. I think we both did. Surely a movie, though, with sunshine in the title, it can't be too challenging, right? Well, the sunshine, it seems, is indeed a secret. The Netflix summary reports, trying to piece her life back together after her husband's death, widow Lee Shin-ai moves to the small village where he was born with her young son in tow. Okay, I stopped there. Husband dies, that's kind of bad, but small village, son, starting over? Sounds pretty good. I go on reading. Life seems to return to normal until the boy is kidnapped, leaving the mother devastated.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man,
that's in the plot description. So, 142 minutes, dead husband and kidnapped son, the single biggest thing that gives me nightmares as a parent. I'm thinking, fantastic, I can't wait. Well, fortunately, misery does love company, and I had the chance to watch Secret Sunshine with our producer, Sam Van Halgren. And in some email exchanges after seeing the movie, he posed a fantastic question that I don't have a great answer to, so I'm going to hit you with it, Josh.
Right.
He says that this is a lead character who is always trying to do the right thing. She tries to be the good wife, or so we hear. She tries to be the good mother, and later, the good Christian. But she only seems to end up with Job-like treatment. So is it worth considering the movie, Sam asks, as a very bleak comedy about someone who fails to experience redemption at every turn? And at one point late in the movie, there even seems to be a little wink at the audience, potentially, from the director when one character says to another, "What a melodrama," and the character responds, "It could be more like a comic melodrama." I'm not sure there's anything truly comic about Secret Sunshine, but there's definitely some absurdity, and that would fit in perfectly with this marathon so far because, as we've discussed, a lot of these films defy you to categorize them. So how do you respond to Sam's provocative question, and did you end up experiencing some redemption after suffering through the main character's suffering?
Yeah, I don't consider it a comedy really at all, and I know what you mean. I know what Sam means by the mix of tones. We've seen that quite a bit. I would actually consider The Chaser, the serial killer thriller, much more of a comedy than this.
I could see that
vein in that film. Here, it really felt what was most jarring is that initial twist when her son is kidnapped, which I didn't know going in.
So that was
in.
A twist for you.
That was a twist for me.
Yeah, for me and Sam, we were just waiting for the scene to happen.
Oh, that's really too bad,
yeah.
Because the film does take a very significant tonal shift. And at first, it threw me off a little bit. But I saw that and further developments, which we really should not get into, as part of a journey. So I sense in Sam's question, and maybe you know if this is what he was getting at as well, or maybe this is how you feel, that there's something too intense about the suffering or too much piling on in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how someone might respond that way because it gets rough. And this is a very, very distressed and increasingly distressed performance given by Jeon Do-young. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of crying, there's a lot of screaming,
mm-hmm.
and yet I found it all layered
right.
and building, and each time she's going through a scene like that, I found it for a different reason than what she did before. So a lot of times movies that are just all about their suffering, here's what it is for me. Suffering mm-hmm. in a film can be a problem if I sense that the movie is more interested in the suffering than the character who's enduring it. And I never got that sense here.
You mean
I think
like
a lot
every
of it,
Inarritu film?
Well, that can happen in some of those films with some of those characters.
Yeah.
And it can happen in like a Michael Haneke picture, some
sure.
of his pictures as well. Here, for some reason, it didn't even occur to me until I started to hear you talk about it this way in your introduction. And I can certainly see how someone would pick up on that. Is that how it struck you, or were you more, I guess I just saw her so, I was so with her as a character,
mm-hmm.
with that specific person, that it never felt to me like the movie was piling it on.
Yeah, I think we came out in the same place, mostly Sam as well. There was, for both of us early on, or at least about halfway through, a fair amount of that piling on. We did feel that a little bit, and there was a part of me that was thinking, okay, as well-intentioned and clearly well-made this movie is, I mean, every scene is there for a purpose. You see the clear artistic choices being made, and clearly Lee Chang-dong is a talented filmmaker. It was a difficult sit just in terms, not so much of the suffering, Josh, but really just wanting something to surprise me. You had a surprise. I don't mean just in terms of plot. I mean any kind of moment that really had some layers to it. And I didn't see it, especially since I knew the change in tone was going to happen with the son. I kept waiting for the movie to go in a direction I wasn't really expecting. So I'm watching the movie. It's like a really nice melody you're listening to, albeit a dark one. But I wanted to get some dissonance. I wanted to get a clashing of tone. I wanted to get something more underneath everything. And I finally got it. It's the scene that ultimately redeemed the whole movie for me, along with one other aspect that you've already touched on, and we'll talk about more in a moment. And I know, Josh, you did say that we probably shouldn't get into this. Well, I'm throwing out the spoiler alert right here. If you don't want to know anything more about this movie before you get a chance to see Secret Sunshine, I guess fast forward to the top five portion of this podcast, because I want to get into it. It is the scene for me, as I said, that redeemed the whole movie. It's the scene in jail where the mother has decided she's
Let's
now...
Let's just say she's encountering the perpetrator of a crime.
She's
can
encountering,
we just leave it at that?
Well, I think we can say that. She's encountering the perpetrator of a crime against her.
Right.
A very serious crime
we
against her.
We should leave
her.
It at that.
Well, she goes to confront this man, and she's going there to forgive him. This is a point in the movie where she's had a change of heart with religion, and you're watching it, and you're thinking, this really could be a wholly genuine, kind, spiritual act. That's why she's going. The act of a true Christian. And that's how it plays out. Until the perpetrator opens his mouth and he explains that he too has found God. He's already found forgiveness, God's forgiveness. And just from the look on her face and her behavior, certainly after leaving, you can tell that this horrifies her. It brings her no pleasure at all. In fact, it just brings her more pain to know that he already feels forgiven and is happy and at peace. That was going to be her forgiveness to bestow. Perhaps even it was going to be an unburdening of her pain onto him, albeit under the guise of this Christian act. And that opportunity has now been taken from her. He's taken that power. The only power she really has left, he's taken from her. God as well has taken that power from her. And that's a scene where she finally, and we're going to talk about this a little bit further because I think it's such a huge portion of this film. It's a scene where she's finally, as the woman, going to exert her power over this man, rather than having the men exert power over her. And of course, he and God take it away from her. And that then changes the whole trajectory of the rest of the film. And that's where I really got on board.
I think it happens a little earlier, actually. I think you're right. That is the key scene. That's the best scene in the film and a key turning point. But I think it was built upon earlier. I saw these things building maybe. For me, they built a little bit ahead of time in the film that they may have for you. And it's when she first embraces her Christianity. Mm-hmm. This is a very perceptive movie about religion in general and Christianity in particular. And there's something off about her early embrace of it. She's recovering from this crime. And initially, she grasps onto it. She had resisted it at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
She grasps onto it here strictly as a balm, as a solution. So the sense is that I will take this on and it will free me of my pain.
Right. And she's embraced it with the same level of force that she also feels pain.
Oh, yeah.
So
she's,
you know, there's
an
extreme.
Intensely feeling woman and maybe an intensely feeling performance.
Quite worker is going to pay off for her.
Well, yeah. There's also something selfish in it. So here's the key. What she's looking for from the religion is, understandably, some relief. And we can tell that it's not quite working for her, even though she goes through the motions. And there are a lot of other characters who are going through the religious motions as well. And this all comes out in that jail scene, because in a way, though you're right, you know, this is the expected Christian thing to do. Her pastor and the other women in her church are all around her supporting her. Oh, you know, you're so good to do this. It's a little bit also of a selfish act in one degree.
For
and
sure.
She doesn't realize that until it comes out that maybe God's forgiveness is more important than yours. And this is
it's
a reality that
yeah.
exposes to her the sense that, you know, maybe this walk she's chosen is not going to make life better. Maybe that's not the ultimate answer here. I mean, there's mm-hmm. even a phrase at one point that one of her parishioners says to her, something about it's very hard to live by God's word. And this is a sense where this is still going to be a struggle for you. And what you had hoped was maybe a solution isn't going to work out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was just, I haven't seen many films deal with that sort of aspect of forgiveness, even something like Dead Man Walking, which is maybe one of the American touchstones that this movie reminded me of. The movie reminded me of a couple American touchstones, actually. I would also mention Higher Ground, the Vera Farmiga film mm-hmm. about faith and
doubt.
I did
think about that film.
And you talked about her dealing with men so often. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore came up quite a bit, too, the Scorsese
yeah,
picture.
That's a good one. Is Ellen Burstyn better in that film than she is in The Exorcist?
Much.
Oh, you say
better.
That with such relish, Josh. It just drives me crazy.
It's undoubtable. You're pitching me one right down the middle there.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I did set you up for that one. But that really was, for me, the biggest thing. It was about her role as a woman and in the society, but also in her dealing with God, how that comes back to just make her more disillusioned and more angry, ultimately, because that's the one thing she's got that nobody can really take away from her, and that maybe only God up there, if he exists in her mind, can understand or embrace, and that's her pain, right? None of these other people can understand what she's actually going through, and that's what's so frustrating about seeing people say, oh, I know you're going through such a hard time,
yeah.
right? And what worse thing could you say to someone, really, than that? Or there are other moments. There's a great one I love, Josh, in this movie where actually she is driving her car after just going through a horrific experience trying to get her kid back, and she almost runs into two people on the street. Or maybe it's a little bit later, but she's had a really, really dramatic moment. She's really upset.
I think this is after she drops the ransom money.
Yeah, that's
off.
What yeah. I was thinking. So she almost hits two people, and they have no sense of forgiveness for her whatsoever. Like, they have no idea where she came from. All they know is she's a bad driver who almost hit them. And those are those kind of moments that shock you back into reality and make you realize that all your pain in the grand scheme of things doesn't really mean anything. Everyone around you doesn't care about your pain. And so for her, that's her one act to be able to, as I said, unburden that pain potentially. And even that's taken from her. God doesn't even let her have that. And so that made me re-examine the whole film. And you start looking at how the men aren't a huge aspect of the movie. If you think about it, it's really her movie. She's in almost every scene.
Oh, for sure.
There is a supporting character who's pretty memorable. It's the actor Song Kang-ho, and he is kind of a love interest, or he's someone who really has feelings for her. And
it's very one-sided, though, which I love that they play it that way, rather than trying to make him a conventional love interest.
People,
great touch.
Yeah, people who know a lot of Korean films will recognize him from Memories of Murder and JSA and a lot of Park Chan-wook films. But other than him, there aren't a lot of men who have major roles in the movie, and yet they all start to add up, and you start to see the way they treat women. And you wonder if clearly Lee Chang-dong is trying to suggest something by that. There's a subplot that's a little bit odd with a young woman who is dating a couple guys, and they're clearly juvenile delinquents, and she kind of pops in and out of the movie. And we see at one point a scene where our lead character watches her get slapped around by a couple of these boys in the alley, and you even see her dad just grab her and really kind of manhandle her because he's so angry with her. There's a couple scenes where we see this shop and these idiot men really sexually harassing a woman, and she just kind of puts up with it. It's just sort of part of what she expects, I guess. But think about the other men here, not only the guy in jail. Her dead husband is kind of a ghost who lingers over this entire movie, in some ways forcing her, even though he's not there, to move back to his hometown. The church is, of course, led by a male pastor, even though I wouldn't say that dynamic's so much about power. But then later in the film, Josh, we get the scene, and I won't say too much to spoil it, but we get a scene with a pharmacist character, and he portends himself to be this upright Christian man. And what happens? She then decides, you know what? I'm going to prove to you, I'm going to prove to God, that he's just as corruptible as anybody else. And sure enough, he is just as corruptible. And even then, he's not really enough of a man to follow through on his corruption. So there are a ton of examples like that. And the last one, Josh, I'll say is her father. It's really interesting to watch the film and only hear at a couple points that clearly this woman has a father who it seems is still alive. And she decides to cut ties with that family completely and move to this town and doesn't say anything to the father about it. And then there's a moment where she's gone through something really traumatic and you hear her cussing at the sky. You hear her just proclaiming a lot of her unhappiness, and she's addressing this father character. And so it's really interesting that these male figures, including the ultimate male figure, God, are hanging over our lead character the whole time in this film. And that's why that scene in particular in the jail, it's really where it all culminated for me, because it's her finally trying to assert herself.
There's one visual touch that emphasizes everything you've just said in about 2 seconds. And it's the one where she's being led to a crime scene and you look down there and there's got to be at least 9 men.
Right.
She's the only woman. And just why there are so many, I think it's got to be to emphasize what you're talking about there, is that she is on her own here as as a woman. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's definitely a thread in the film. And going back to the guy she tries to seduce, I mean, that's at the point where she's just gone AWOL. And she's going to take down, there are other things she does by subverting a prayer service with a song. I mean, that's a great scene. And she is just going to let out her anger and her defiance. And this is a performance that just keeps ratcheting up. So going back to that, it's why I never found it to be piling on, because it was hitting. They were all notes of severe distress and anger.
Yeah.
Yet somehow they felt different in each scene.
No, you're exactly right. And that is the other big redeeming aspect of this film. It is that lead performance. She's a really interesting, complex character. I think we've well established that by now. You know, not only in that one scene where she has to act out so many different emotions, where she's looking across the table from the man that caused her so much pain, but even when you think about, Josh, the fact that she's someone who clearly loves her son and shows it in a lot of ways, but she's also the woman who one night decides to go out partying with her girlfriends or the other women on the block.
That's
and
the shot in
leaves
the film
him alone.
Where
yeah.
they're going from the karaoke room
yeah.
and she gets the phone call.
Yep.
I mean, wow, is that well done.
Yeah, it is really well done. She's also someone who presents herself as very humble. She's not necessarily rich, though she has clearly come into a little bit of money and is trying to set herself up. But she loves people knowing that she's about to buy land. She's taking on that kind of male dominant role in society of being a landowner. And she does relish that, even though she tries to portray herself otherwise. She also really hates people judging her and talking about her and suggesting constantly how they're looking out for her and how they can help her. And yet, what does she do in one instance? She does the same exact thing. She goes into a shop and says, you know, I think you could stand a little makeover here in the store. And she really acts the exact same way. Even if her intentions are good, she acts the exact same way those other neighbors do. So she's playing multiple notes, to use your expression there, at all times. And it's a really nuanced, gut-wrenching at times performance. And when I learned after the fact that she won the Best Actress at Cannes that year, 2007, of course I understood why. It's a really, really remarkable performance. And so when everything else in the movie wasn't really surprising me, her performance was always keeping me engaged.
Joan does something really small as an actress, and this is in the screenplay, I'm sure, too. Right at the start, that kind of sets the ground for this escalating hysteria that she eventually goes to. And it's a crying scene that's a fake crying scene. When her son hides, she comes home, he's been alone, and he hides, and it's a game they play. You get the feeling. So to get him to come out, she sits down and starts whimpering like, oh, I can't find him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's bad acting.
Yeah.
And she's purposefully bad acting there so that we can hold that moment in our heads when she starts to really fall apart. And for me, you know, that's what first came to mind immediately the first time she starts coming apart is that earlier scene and the range there and the truthfulness, even though it's also acting mm-hmm. in the later scenes, is really something.
Yeah, and I think that whale, that sequence is absolutely one that stuck out for me as well because it tied in with something else I've kind of hinted at, but that was the sense, and Josh, maybe you disagree or other people watching can disagree, but it really did resonate with me, this idea that even though ultimately she finds some solace in religion, at least for a little bit, when you see someone like that in that scene, you see the way people are singing the songs about Jesus and they're talking about pain and suffering, but it's one thing to talk about it and even see it a little bit in their faces, but then when you see it in the form of Li Shinai, when you see her then and she finally has unleash that, it's bare in a way that makes you think that society or certain groups are very good about saying, this is what we're here for. We're here to help you get through this pain and we're going to get you through these challenges. But what I think this movie really shows is that when you get beyond the platitudes, when you get beyond the challenges that are difficult for sure, but are the kind of challenges that many of us face, when you see true suffering, I mean true Job-like suffering, which is what this woman feels, these groups aren't necessarily equipped to deal with that. And that's not a slight against them. I don't know who really would be. I don't know which people in our world would be truly equipped to handle that, except others that have gone through it.
I think here it's more an issue of, are they equipped to solve it, to heal her permanently, to make her whole?
Right.
And when a group like that offers Pollyanna-ish platitudes, to use your word, mm-hmm. that offer that as a solution, that's not going to work.
No,
or
it's not going to
work at all, and it's not going to last. And if anything, if the movie is anything, it's an indictment of a group that would use that sort of promise to someone when it's not what they're going to be able to provide. Mm. They're not going to be able to make her whole again.
Yeah, and one of the other things I'll just throw out here at the end, because Sam asked this, and it's really a great question, one I wouldn't have thought of on my own. He was wondering how much this movie would play differently to a Korean audience versus us Americans watching the movie. Think about things like the embracing of Christianity, which is obviously becoming more and more popular, not the traditional religion there, though. Things like those patriarchal elements that are clearly on display. Just some of the customs in terms of, and we can say this about any of the films we've watched from another country, but it really was heightened here a little bit once Sam pointed it out. When you see how they interact with each other and you wonder how that would play out, that same sequence between two American shop owners versus two Korean, is there a different dynamic? I'd love to hear from some Korean listeners or people who have spent some time in South Korea, and I know we have some of those listeners, if they could comment on that, because I'd be really curious.
In some ways, it almost reminds you of one of these low-budget evangelical films that you would find in the United States. So it's a bit like asking, how would a movie play in the United States? Well, who's going to see it? A group bust in from a church that would, right. you know, eagerly embrace the message? And I guess that's what I appreciated about the film is that for a little while there, you wondered if it's going in that direction, where it was going to be some sort of evangelical tract. But as I suggested, it's completely more nuanced than that. So the
Definitely
answer to your
is.
Question would very much be, well, which Korean is watching it? Is it a Christian Korean?
Sure.
Is it? And there are references, too, which I thought were interesting, to traditional religion or traditional beliefs. The guys who are going up to the mountaintop and they mm-hmm. kind of joke about it. And you get a sense that for them, it's definitely more of a ritual. So there are some elements there, too. So, yeah, that would be really interesting to hear if we have Korean listeners.
Well, that was a very long discussion about the fifth film in our Korean Auteurs Marathon, Secret Sunshine. We do have one more film left. It is A Tale of Two Sisters, a movie that is going to be about more suffering, at least in the horror guise.
Supposedly. Knows where it'll go?
That's true.
I mean,
that's the one thing about these films is you want to label them and you find that you really can't label them. That is coming up, I think, in a couple weeks on the show. But if you want to know for sure, you want to follow along, just follow us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and we will keep you apprised of the schedule.
From small town Korea to the American South. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next with our favorite Southern movies. I'm still holding out for that film version of TV's Designing Women.
Love Delta Burke.
Yep. Stay with us.
Stephanie says that she wants to know why she's given half her life to people she hates now. Stephanie says country shall I say is calling from across the world.
Everybody, we did want to jump in with our donation segment here, as we like to say thank you to our listeners who have been so generous as to go to filmspotting.net, go to PayPal, and send some hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. And Josh, we're going to continue the international theme coming off that last segment where we discussed Secret Sunshine from South Korea, and we talked about the African film that won Best Animated Movie at the Chicago Film Festival. There's going to be a lot of international listeners who decided this past week to donate to the show. We start with a listener who is not from foreign soil, but he is a $10 a month donor to Film Spotting.
That would be Clayton from Whittier, California.
We go to some new $5 a month donors. Here's one of them, Gustavo.
In Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
We also heard from Jerry O'Keefe, and he comes to us not even from another state, Joliet, Illinois.
That's
just right
close.
Down the road. Yeah.
Like many other listeners, it finally occurred to me that it's criminal to not donate the cost of a few morning coffees every month to support what's easily my favorite podcast. Since I started listening several years ago, I've consistently been impressed with your ability to entertain and educate your listeners on the world of cinema. I recently started co-hosting a movie podcast with friends, and we all hold Film Spotting in the highest regard as the gold standard of what a podcast should be.
Wow, thank you for the kind words, and thank you, Jerry, for your donation. Of course, he sent us in his note as well some nice comments about his conversion over to you, Josh, as a co-host. He was a little skeptical, but he's come to finally
embrace
you.
We wouldn't want to read any of those, though.
But one thing he did say about Maddie, and I want to give this a little bit of a shout out because it allows Jerry the opportunity to chastise us and Michael Phillips for our top five themes. He says that Maddie was responsible for convincing him to give 2008 Speed Racer a chance, and it's now become a film I recommend to friends as an underrated favorite. Imagine my dismay during your top five movie themes recently as the three of you spent a good couple of minutes singing the praises of Michael Giacchino's wonderful work and didn't even mention his fantastic score for Speed Racer. Oh well, I guess not everyone can appreciate the great touches of a film that has had the word Skittles used to describe it more than any other. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to keep listening.
Yeah, I am not among the Speed Racer apologists.
See, I'm shocked.
Sorry.
I'm shocked. I would have thought you loved it.
Couldn't go that far.
I would have thought it was top five material for you for sure, Josh, but yeah, I can't go there either. Still, a nice note. Thank you so much, Jerry. We also got a Silver Club donation from Daniel in Brooklyn.
Hi, Adam and Josh and the whole Film Spotting crew. For my wife and I, this donation and note have been a long time coming. Your show has been an invaluable presence in our lives, especially since we moved to Brooklyn from Columbus, Ohio last year.
And then I think Daniel had more to say, Josh, and the PayPal note area cut him off.
Oh.
He may have sent another email. I couldn't find it. Daniel, I apologize if you had something else eloquent to share with our audience. And if you do, feel free to resend that email. We'll definitely check it out. Let's end on that international theme here, Josh, as we go to a few other donors we want to thank this week. Mart in Tartu, Estonia?
Tartuma, it says.
Estonia.
Yeah.
I think that's our first ever Estonia donation.
Very nice.
And we also heard from Thomas in Regensburg, Germany. A little bit easier to say, though I still probably got it wrong. Thank you to all of our new donors and our monthly subscribers this week. We have to mention as well, because it keeps working for us, if you aren't ready to donate to the show, you can always support us by going to iTunes and leaving a review of the show, positive, of course, or rating us positively there. We had a push over the past 4 to 6 weeks, maybe even a little less, to get to 1,000 reviews. I think when we started, we were at 830 or something like that. We are now well over 1,000.
Excellent.
It
we shouldn't
worked.
Have said that. We should have just said,
I know.
We need 1,000.
Yeah, please
yet.
Go. But you know what? We'll just set a new target of 1,500, and we'll
there
keep you urging
go.
You to get there. We appreciate all the kind words that we get. A couple other quick notes before we go with this segment. We want to plug this great film festival that we have annually here on the show. The note comes to us, as it always does, from a longtime listener named Leonard Bushell, and he asks us to help promote the 2013 Real Recovery Film Festival. It's a festival presented by Writers in Treatment. Their primary purpose is to save lives through promoting and providing treatment as the best first step solution for addiction that includes alcoholism and other self-destructive behaviors. And unfortunately, we just missed, Josh, the plug for October in L.A. It ran in L.A. from October 18th through the 24th, but there are other festival screenings coming up in Delray Beach, in San Francisco, and in Sacramento. So if that sounds like something you want to participate in, you want to see some of the movies they're going to be screening as part of that Real Recovery Film Festival, just go to realrecoveryfilmfestival.org, and we'll also link to that in our show notes. Finally, the music this week, kind of a no-brainer, right, with the passing of Lou Reed. We did have to go with some of his music, and it works out nicely because he has had many songs over the years featured in movie soundtracks, some really good movie soundtracks and really good movies, and I think you hear two of them in this show. Stephanie Says from The Royal Tenenbaums and Satellite of Love from Adventureland. So a little tribute there to Lou Reed.
But doesn't hang up the phone. What seashell sea is calling from across the world? But she's not afraid to die. The people all call her Alaska.
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Macon was a tired old town, even in 1932 when I first knew it. Somehow it was hotter then. Men's stiff collars wilted by 9 in the morning. Ladies bathed before noon, after their 3 o'clock naps. And by nightfall were like soft tea cakes with frostings of sweat and sweet talcum. A day was 24 hours long, but it seemed longer.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and Josh, I just couldn't resist one more time as we get to the Film Spotting Top 5 movies set in the South. Playing To Kill a Mockingbird, your favorite movie.
At least this means it's not on your list, though.
Well, it's not on my list because I'm calling my list the To Kill a Mockingbird Memorial List.
Oh, boy.
How can
you can't have your own memorial list.
Well,
they have to be joint memorial lists.
No, apparently you're not familiar with the history of this show, sir. Because
Only you get to declare them memorial
co-hosts
lists.
Co-hosts as well. We've had individual memorial lists. It just hasn't happened, really, since you joined the show.
Well, I'm going to start throwing them around all over the place.
We've managed to find common ground, but we will not find common ground, alas, on To Kill a Mockingbird. That does get us in. Do our top five movies set in the South, inspired by the discussion earlier in the show of 12 Years a Slave. And another movie you won't find on either of our lists is Cool Hand Luke. The reason being, simply, it's in the Film Spotting Pantheon.
And we agree on that one.
Our favorite films. It's a great film, and it just doesn't count for this particular list, but we do really, really love Cool Hand Luke, that film, of course, starring Paul Newman. So with To Kill a Mockingbird, with Cool Hand Luke out of the way, Josh, do you want to throw out any other disclaimers, any other films or any other types of movies we didn't cover?
We did set aside Texas, correct? And the city of New Orleans, and then Florida. We figured let's just throw out Florida.
Yeah, for me, I didn't really factor Florida much in at all, though it's true I don't really consider it the South. When you say the South,
we're thinking like Deep South,
yeah,
a little bit. Yeah, that's kind of where I went to. So
yeah.
I think we'll have avoided
Texas,
Florida, and Texas is its own thing.
It really is its own country, and I know many residents of Texas feel that way, so that did seem appropriate to leave it off. And I don't know how many movies have been set in New Orleans. I know several, but enough to do your own top five? Well, probably.
Definitely.
We may find out at some point. So with all of those disclaimers, that does bring us to our list. What do you got?
Well, I have a caveat, too. I did just come off of 9 days away, and a lot of that was off the grid, so I had little chance to catch up with some movies, and maybe you'll have them that I really felt were deserving of either consideration or reconsideration. So something like The Birth of a Nation, which I've never been able to see,
mm-hmm.
should have watched it for this list. Also would have liked to take a fresh look at Gone with the Wind and wasn't able to do that. I can't really say. I saw it so long ago.
Hmm.
So, and I know that's one that you have had a lot of pressure to watch.
Right.
I'm assuming you didn't catch up with it for this list?
No, I didn't even consider it. Not that I had the time, but no, it didn't even cross my mind because, yes, famously or somewhat infamously, Gone with the Wind is one of my big regrets, though I don't really regret it. I'm sorry. You can just discard everything I'm about to say. I'm sure it's a masterpiece.
It's a big regret you'll never make up for.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
I'm glad we got that out of the
way. It's not going to be on my list. And I know we did cover this, but just real quick before you dive in, Josh, when we say Texas movies, you have to think about a lot of great films. The Thin Blue Line, Lone Star, The Searchers.
Yeah, it could easily
be its own list.
So many
great westerns, The Last Picture Show. You can even go with other movies that some people might consider the South, but just didn't really feel right to me. The great Terrence Malick film, Badlands, for example, where they travel over. Easy Rider, I know they hit parts of the South, but just didn't really feel like they made as much sense for a movie set in the South, like To Kill a Mockingbird, like Cool Hand Luke, or like the other ones on my list.
So here's how I organized mine. I thought of the things that came to mind when I first thought of the Deep South, these states we're talking about, and there were a couple of themes. So there was music that came to mind. poverty came to mind. Food came to mind. Race and justice. You know, think about everything from Civil War to civil rights.
Right.
So I tried to organize. That helped me choose. There was such a rich array of films you could have picked for this list. It helped me choose the ones that I think best represented, of course, as a lifelong Northerner, to me, the South.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start with music. And it's going to be Idlewild. This is the 2006 Outkast musical that's made up of songs from the hip-hop duo's previous albums that are reworked a bit here. So it is set in Prohibition-era Georgia. It has Outkast's Andre Benjamin and Antoine Patton as a pair of opposite personalities who, nevertheless, they've been friends since childhood, and they both perform at this speakeasy. And it's my music pick, though admittedly the music is anachronistic. You know, Nashville, another good title for this list, probably represents better Southern music. The songs here, they're out of time and out of place, but they do capture the musical spirit of the South, maybe more than the exact notes. They capture this spirit, and it's one, in this movie at least, that's raucous, it's free, it's this rebel yell, but in hip-hop form.
Whether you like it or not, he's back. D-A-double-D-Y, that's X. Sharp as a tack, like I just left church. Sparked and attacked when the shit won't work me.
Idlewild was compared favorably by those who went for it, like I did, and unfavorably by those who thought it was a big mess, to Moulin Rouge. Maybe it already
Another
sounds
movie you
like
love.
That. I do love Moulin Rouge. It's probably why I went for Idlewild. I mean, if you do love Baz Luhrmann's picture, you're probably going to go for this as well.
Not a lot of movies over the course of the almost 9 years of doing this show that have never been uttered once on the air, and Idlewild and Outkast. Those are two words that have never been said, I think, on
the
show.
Then I'm going to make this the Idlewild Memorial List.
You would. Well, I will let you sit there and think about your pick of Idlewild up against my pick that you can feel some shame for. It is The Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffin. How can it not be at least considered, Josh, for this list? It does make my list. It's a film set primarily in South Carolina. This is, of course, the 1915 silent drama, as I said, directed by Griffith. And it's really about two families in Civil War era South and also during the Reconstruction. We do see over the course of the movie the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. That's dramatized there in the movie. It's a marathon film, actually, from here on Film Spotting. Third or fourth marathon we did on the show back in 2006, a silent movie marathon. And the question I posed to then co-host Sam Van Halgren was, this is a movie that essentially invented modern film language. It's the first movie to use night shots, to use panning shots, cross-cutting, a lot of pioneering techniques. But when you watch it, as everyone knows who has seen it or read anything about film history, you know that its racism is appalling. It really might be the single most racially offensive piece of mainstream entertainment ever. And so you can't help but see it and wrestle with the question, are those achievements, are those technical achievements enough to compensate for its ideology? So that was the question Sam and I wrestled with in that review. And the short answer is we both decided, yes, ultimately it is. It's worth seeing the movie and discussing it and reveling to some extent in those sequences and some of those great cinematic techniques. And it all comes together, Josh. The whole conundrum of this movie is really established in the finale, this big action sequence, where the way it's cross-cut and the use of music and the action in it, you find yourself getting swept up in it. At the same time, you realize that what you're getting swept up in is you're essentially rooting for the Ku Klux Klan, which none of us reasonable people would ever want to do in real life. But the movie does compel you to do that. So you have to wrestle with it when you watch the film. But nevertheless, it's suspenseful, it's interesting, and you do eventually have to catch yourself and realize kind of the horror of what you're watching. But is it worth it as an experience, and is it worth it as a document of the way Griffith, anyway, and the filmmakers saw the South and the Reconstruction of the South after the Civil War? Yeah, I think it's a document that has to be contended with.
Well, an ideology is far easier to set aside when you're dealing with it within a historical document, which is what this is, right? I mean, we would have an entirely different conversation if a movie like this came out a few years ago or even today. So, yeah, that is a difficult question and one that's been wrestled with forever with films other than Birth of a Nation. My number four is going to be a familiar title, one that I tried to keep off this list, but once I thought of those themes, it kept popping up. It's Beasts of the Southern Wild. Food. It's something I didn't even talk about in all the times that I went on and on about my favorite movie of last year.
You found something you didn't talk about?
Yes.
I don't believe it.
I can't believe I let this slip.
Scour the transcripts.
I can't believe it. Now, this is a movie all about this coping imagination of this little girl played by Quvenzhané Wallace, who lives with her ailing and really unreliable father in this mythical sort of Delta community. People know it by now. And food does play a huge part of her coping, now that I think about it. And it's distinctly Southern food. Remember the Beast-It Feast. It's this fish boil where there's this ravenous cracking of crabs that they have with neighbors. That great memory of her mother, again, a mythical memory, where she would just pass the stove and it would light up because she was such a magical figure to this girl. And then there's that later scene where she meets her mother, or at least it's a mother figure, on a floating barge, and she gets this meal of fried alligator cooked for her. So it's just this other thread going through the film that's rooted in the culture of the South, and it was just too good a fit once I started thinking about all the cooking in it.
I think you can be forgiven time for that. Josh, you did find a new angle to explore anyway. As we get further into our list and my number four, I want to go back to a quick comment you made where you said that, you know, we are coming at these lists as lifelong Northerners. That's definitely the case for both
Iowa's
of us.
Iowa's the North, right?
Iowa does count as the Union, if it were, Josh. Thank you very much. But believe me, it is not lost on me for those people listening who are in those southern states that I do not proclaim to understand this entire region, especially when I've never lived in it and have only visited for a few weeks at a time. So I am going, as we get through these picks, to try to avoid painting in too broad a strokes. But it occurred to me that notions of the South that I have, they're really largely driven, of course, by movies and literature, including the short stories of Flannery O'Connor, who was a Southern woman who loved the South, but she also loved writing about the South's hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of religion and Christians in particular, as she saw it, who talk about loving thy neighbor. They talk about the golden rule, but of course often prove themselves to be some of the most racist, bigoted, exclusionary people you'll ever find. So all that's probably a too serious setup for my number four pick, especially when it's a comedy. But that hypocrisy really drives the movie. It's where the title comes from.
Talladega Nights.
It is not Talladega Nights. It really should be. It is Our Hospitality, the film from Buster Keaton. He plays Willie in the film, and he is the heir to not much of an estate that's left over, and actually a state I can't remember, Josh. I don't know if the movie ever specifically says where, but it could be a West Virginia, Kentucky type of state, because the central drama, the central conflict, is patterned after the famous Hatfield and McCoys feud. Here it's the Canfields and McKays, and he is the next in line for the McKays. His mom, when his father was killed, took him away to be safe in New York and to be taken away from this feud and not know anything about it. But then he does eventually have to go down south, and he is told of this longstanding feud and doesn't realize that he's actually been invited to come to dinner. The woman he rode on the train with is played by Natalie Talmadge, the great silent film actress. She's the daughter of a Canfield. And he gets invited to dinner one night, and everyone becomes aware of exactly who he is, and the feud takes center stage. At one point, the father of the Canfields tells his boys that they'll show him their version of Southern hospitality, which in this case includes they're going to kill him. And they're going to kill him for no good reason other than the fact that his father was once someone that this family feuded with. But they're not going to kill him as long as he's a guest in their home. That's what they can't do. As soon as he steps foot outside, he's fair game. And that's a scenario I have to think that Flannery O'Connor probably would have loved, that great irony and the richness of that. Most of the movie is Buster Keaton's character devising tactics to either stay in the house or evade the Canfield boys when he's out of it. There really are some hilarious gags in the movie, including one where, you know, it's something you see in cartoons so much that followed this, where they're trying to shoot him with a gun, but he doesn't realize that they're going to eventually try to aim the gun at him, and he helps them fix the gun. You get moments like that from Buster Keaton, but the big one is the waterfall scene where he's out on a ledge by a waterfall. There's a tree branch, a big branch, and he's hanging onto it with a rope. And just as Talmadge is about to go over, he swoops in and rescues her like a trapeze artist. And that really is a stunning sequence when you watch it even now, but especially when you go back and realize it was made in 1923. And that's really one of the great pleasures, among many pleasures, watching a Buster Keaton film, is some of those stunts, some of those action sequences he pulled off. But in particular, that sense of potential Southern hypocrisy that really comes through is a big reason why Our Hospitality had to make my list.
Man, your third pick, we're going to be all the way up to the 1930s, huh? You're
might
really
get
going
there.
Way back. Nicely done.
I'm trying to give listeners a sense of film history.
I like
Josh.
That. I
you know,
like it
as,
a lot.
As you're going all the way back to Outcast,
Well, I'll go back a little further here balanced. With number three. I'm going to go all the way back to 1962. I can't go quite as far as you. And no, it's not To Kill a Mockingbird the same
year.
Of
course it's not.
I'd much rather give this slot to Cape Fear. Also has Gregory Peck, of course, but really it has Robert Mitchum. That's who you remember, right, as Max Cady.
Don't mind me, Counselor. I'm just getting a gander at the rest of your family. Yeah, you're a lucky man.
Did you see my stride, Daddy? Did you?
Recently released from prison for rape and now seeking revenge on Peck's Georgia lawyer, the lawyer who put him there. Peck's just, he's a tad less noble here than he is in Mockingbird. Justice is a very messy and complicated thing here in this movie, even though it involves a despicable character like Cady. I mean, Mitchum is so menacing here. You think this would be a clear-cut case, right? He's the bad guy. But after the law fails to rein Cady in, and there's some great Southern police chiefs and deputies in this picture, that's when Peck's lawyer goes after Cady himself, and especially when his wife and daughter become threatened. So in many ways, this is, you know, your standard vigilante plot. I think we got a couple movies pretty much like this in the last few months, at least in terms of plot line. But here in Cape Fear, you really do get this Southern justice twist.
Well, now what's to be, Lord? Another widow? How many's it been? 6? 12? I just remember. You say the word, Lord. I'm on my way.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and I'll see your Robert Mitchum as Max Cady and give you Robert Mitchum as the Reverend Harry Powell in Charles Laughton's 1955 film. We're all the way up to 1955, Josh, The Night of the Hunter. I'll also keep my Flannery O'Connor angle going a little bit with a movie blatantly about religion in the South and hypocrisy, or at least the duality of man displayed and explained so eloquently by Mitchum with his fists and those tattoos, love and hate. O'Connor also, I should note, loved huckster. She loved salesmen. She loved con artists. She would have loved a really despicable, vile character like Harry Powell, who, of course, the central plot of the film is his trying to woo this widow and get the fortune of her dead husband, some money he stole and set aside. She does have 2 children as well, and he tries to ingratiate himself into that family just to get the money. He sees what he can use against people, how he can prey on them, and religion is a big way he can get himself into not only her house, but into this whole town. And the scary thing about the Harry Powell character is he really means it. He's a guy who isn't just a con artist. He's someone who has real faith in his convictions, and there's a real righteousness to his actions. He's one of the most spiteful characters ever, just filled with loathing for his fellow man. And I don't know that anybody can love Robert Mitchum on screen as much as Roger Ebert loved watching Robert Mitchum on screen, but I'm also a big fan, and I certainly agree with him with his take on the movie. He said, it is one of the most frightening of movies, with one of the most unforgettable of villains, and on both of those scores, it holds up as well after 4 decades. So he obviously revisited. I know so many Film Spotting listeners who have discovered this movie over the last 10 years or so, and there's no doubt it holds up. It's a great film, directed, of course, famously by Charles Laughton, who never made another one after it.
Now I'm in suspense to see if you're going to put a color film on your list. This is going to be really something.
I may.
Good. My number 2, Mississippi Masala, 1991 film from director Mira Nair. And this is the pick that really addresses race in an interesting and complicated way. It is an interracial romance that's set in the South, and the romance is between Denzel Washington's African-American man, Demetrius, and Sarita Chaudhuri's Mina, who is of Indian descent. And there are so many complications here because Mina's family has actually moved to America from Uganda, where they and other Asians were kicked out in the 70s by dictator Idi Amin. So now put this story right into the American South, where race relations are already tenuous, and you really have this multi-layered consideration of things like prejudice and assimilation in other cultures. It's a really interesting narrative here. And even though all of that is going on, Washington and Chaudhuri, they keep the focus personal, so it stays on these two people. They're really tender performances in this film. So Mississippi Masala is my number 2.
My number 2 is a movie that's good for a top 5 appearance every 2 years or so, it seems. It made my top 5 Fight the Power movies in 2007. It made my top 5 poverty movies in 2009. And a few years ago in 2011, my top 5 documentaries, favorite documentaries ever. Josh, I challenge you now, what is the movie?
Is this going to be that one about tobacco and the guy going on about his family?
Bright Leaves. Bright I did leaves. Consider that. Ross McElwee. You just don't understand the genius of Ross McElwee. And I mean that seriously. You don't understand Ross McElwee. Sherman's March, a film I strongly consider for this list, but will not make the top five. I am going, no, with the film Harlan County, USA, from director Barbara Koppel, a film set in Kentucky. And as we've touched on some of these different themes, you in particular with your list, I do think about those coal miners and a lot of great movies that have been set in that milieu. Make One from John Sayles, Coal Miner's Daughter, the Sissy Spacek film, I do enjoy quite a bit. But Harlan County for me is the definitive portrait of people in that time, in that environment, and how they go on with their lives when they're working such a terrible job and such a dangerous job and going up against forces like the company, the Duke Power Company here that owns this mine and is not wanting to give them any type of wage or benefits that would allow them to embrace the American dream, if you will. And I love that actually in the title. If you think about it, I don't know if this was by design or not, but the fact that it's Harlan County, USA, I feel like that's Koppel just adding an exclamation point there saying, no, this really isn't another world. This type of life, this way of life, and the way these people are being treated is not foreign. It is something that is happening right here in America. And she did go on to make kind of the northern version of this dispute in the mid-80s when she made American Dream, set in a Hormel meatpacking plant. That's a very good movie as well. But back to Harlan County real quick, a film that as a documentary just builds suspense. It really does feel, John Sayles said this about the movie, that it feels like you're watching a fiction film at times because you just get the idea that you know the violence is going to sort of burst over at some point and this is going to come to a head. One of the things I remember from our discussion when this film was reviewed here on Film Spotting a few years back is that you really get the sense watching it that these are people who are trapped by history. And I think that can go for a lot of people in the South with their history, with that legacy and the baggage they carry with it. There's this sense that tradition and culture really overrides a lot of what they do. And there's an idea that things are the way they are because that's kind of always been the way it is. And you either can deal with it or you can strike back against it. And these characters do seem really trapped in by history. They're always comparing this struggle to the bloody Harlan days of the 30s. And they have this really somewhat antiquated notion that, you know, if we just stick together, solidarity will overcome and we can do this. But, you know, it's not the 30s anymore. It's the 1970s. And the way they're being treated in these big corporations that run their lives, they can't fight back against them using the same tactics they did then. The world is changing, and this paradigm shift is something they're really struggling with as they're trying to embrace the modern world.
They're treating us like that we're animals, dogs. Well, we aren't. We're American citizens. And they are violating their constitutional rights when they tell us that we can't have the union of our choice that those men voted in. If you looked on TV the other day, you seen women going up there, men, impeach Nixon, impeach Nixon. But you let us get up there with protest signs against Duke Power, and they're sending their gun thugs to intimidate us.
Harlan County, USA, I'm all the way up to the 70s, Josh, for my number two.
Nice work. All right, my number one, it's another film that I named as the best of its respective year, like Beasts. So there's something about the South, I guess, that appeals to me at year-end lists. It's a Missouri-set story, Winter's Bone.
So you're going Missouri is the South?
Yeah, I thought so. I looked at it on a map, actually.
Okay.
I think it counts. We'll see what listeners say.
Fair enough.
We'll see what Southerners say. Maybe I'm all off on this. But there's a reason why it fit for this list, and it has to do, again, with the idea, like your pick, of poverty and how it plays out in the storyline here. This follows a teen girl played by Jennifer Lawrence who goes in search of her missing father. He's disappeared, which has left the family at risk of losing their dilapidated home. They're kind of on the edge already, and then his disappearance threatens to push them over. So it's very much not only about poverty, but specifically the rural isolation that can attend it, especially in the South. And the movie really takes time for details that have to do with this. I think about that scene with Bree, Lawrence's character, when she's teaching her younger siblings how to hunt and skin a squirrel because she knows there's a chance they're going to actually need this for survival. This isn't a hobby. They're going to need to know how to do this to live.
I'm just going to slit it down here. Now get in there, get them guts out.
I don't want to.
Sonny, there's a bunch of stuff that you're going to have to get over being scared of.
I'm not scared. I just don't want to.
Come on.
So as Bree makes her way through this really sketchy community they're a part of, I mean, the people have now taken to the cooking and selling of methamphetamine in order to get by. You come to this slow, horrible realization that she really is all on her own and increasingly at great risk as she goes on. The director is Deborah Granick, and she has some really amazing, ominous imagery here. I think about that midnight boat trip across a lake that's especially eerie. And it just encourages this sense of the rural South as a place that's full of terrible and dangerous history, going back to this idea of history you talked about. So Winter's Bone, my number one movie of 2010, my number one here.
I'm just glad you didn't go with Cedar Rapids and try to argue that Iowa was indeed
that's
the South.
That's why I asked you. I wanted to make sure.
Well, Winter's Bone, we're actually somewhat in agreement on that film. I think it was in my top five of that year. So
awesome.
I'm not willing to go number one, but I did really like that movie. My number one movie set in the South, I am going back to the 60s a little bit here for it, and it's In the Heat of the Night. We're going to start with the South and race for me in this list with Birth of a Nation. We're going to end with race as well, which seems appropriate to me. It was my number two small town movie a few years ago here on the show. And it really has one of my all-time favorite screen performances, Rod Steiger as Chief Gillespie. Yes, Sidney Poitier is fantastic, too, as Virgil Tibbs. He gets stuck in Sparta, Mississippi. He's on his way back to the big city, Philadelphia, where, let's just say, he doesn't have to confront on a daily basis the same kind of racism he confronts when he gets stuck in Sparta, and he gets involved in a murder case there. This is a film, for me, I just could quote all day long. And I think I've probably said it. I think Steiger's performance is one for me that's one of those great big performances that's never too big for the movie. It never overrides anything that's happening. Every time you look at him and you get one of those great line readings, it's all grounded. It's all justified. You understand where he's coming from as a character. And of course, the real famous line from the movie is, "They call me Mr. Tibbs." And that's an important line in what it says about this character, Virgil, asserting his identity in this place and time. But for me, the key exchange, and the big reason why it not only made this list but was my number one, is the conversation about two-thirds of the way through the movie with Mr. Endicott, who they're going to question about his potential involvement, what he might know about this murder case. He's the old, white, wealthy man sitting on his big estate with his older black butler nearby, and Poitier comes in to question him, and when he does, very directly, it leads Endicott to slap him. And what does Virgil Tibbs do? He slaps him back.
Gillespie? Yeah. You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
It's such a powerful sequence. And that line he says to him, "There was a time when I could have had you killed for that." This guy, like so many people in the South at that time, still hanging on to these old notions of race and power. And I love when he says to Gillespie, "Did you see that?" And Rod Steiger says, "I saw it." And he says, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" He says, "I don't know." And he really doesn't know. I mean, he's so shocked by what he just saw happen. That idea of a black man in that place slapping a white man, an old wealthy white man, it's just unthinkable, and it really does stun all of them. And I think the power of that moment for audiences in 1967, white or black, that had to resonate. I think it's stunning now to watch it, just knowing the set of rules that Endicott thinks the world still operates under. And at the end of the scene, there's just this great little coda where Tibbs and Gillespie walk out, and the black butler, the older man, is about to head out the door behind him, and he turns and he shakes his head at Endicott. And you wonder, is he actually shaking his head at his boss? Like, "I can't believe you did that. I can't believe that you said that directly, that I would kill you for that, or I could have killed you for that in a different time." Probably not. He's actually more than likely shaking his head at being just as stunned as everyone else that that just happened, and maybe shaking his head in admonition at the young black man who doesn't understand how the world should work, and that's not his place. You don't really know. The movie doesn't spell it out. So In the Heat of the Night is my number one movie set in the South, and those are our top five movies set in the South. What about any honorable mentions?
It's really a shame I couldn't find a place for a David Gordon Green film.
Yeah.
All the Real Girls, which is my favorite of his. George Washington, you could have counted. Undertow as well, which is sort of his Mud, which makes me ask, how was Jeff Nichols not on your list? I mean, Shotgun Stories and Mud especially, I think, could have been. I thought about both of those.
They are honorable mentions.
All right, good. Ballast, I thought about. That's a 2008 indie set in the Mississippi Delta, really worth checking out. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou would have fit nicely in my music theme. Eve's Bayou is the Cassie Lemon film,
New Orleans,
which is really
good. Or is it just Louisiana?
It's more Louisiana area, which we did kind of allow. That's how I squeaked Beast of the Southern Wild in, even though that's kind of a fantasy land. Two more here. The Apostle, although I had that on my list recently of top five movies directed by their stars. And, of course, Glory, the Ed Zwick film with Denzel Washington's breakout role.
I did see people on Twitter suggesting, okay, how many Jeff Nichols films is Adam going to put in there? I did really strongly consider, as I said, Shotgun Stories and Mud. And Mud's a film, too. I didn't have time to read this story. I'm sure it's great. I'm going to link to it anyway because it's so appropriate for our list. I did find in doing a Google search that there was an IndieWire article from the time that Mud came out that argues why Mud is the best Southern film in years.
Well, there you go.
I'm sure it makes a good case. We'll link to that in the show notes over at filmspotting.net. Other movies I did consider, Sherman's March, I mentioned the film from Ross McElwee, Nashville, the Robert Altman film. I know you left off Florida, but you can go Vernon, Florida. For me, the documentary from Errol Morris. I like both Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan from director Craig Brewer. The General, another very good classic Buster Keaton movie. I also thought about All the Real Girls from David Gordon Green. One False Move is another movie. Mm-hmm. Carl Franklin, a movie set in, I believe, Arkansas, Star City, Arkansas. I really do love that thriller. And the last movie I want to mention, and look, there are 20 more we could probably mention that are good films. One more that I don't think a lot of people are aware of, and it's hard to find. I'm not sure you can really see it anywhere. Wikipedia doesn't have a page for it, let's put it that way. But it's a movie that I think I got a screener of back in 2005, and it's a movie called CSA.
Yes, I've seen that
one. You have.
One.
It's a satirical documentary. I don't know if it really works because I don't know that it's actually all set in the South, but the CSA is the Confederate States of America. It's this documentary, this faux documentary that portends that this British documentary crew has come over to document how America is since the Civil War. And the general conceit of the movie is that the South won the war. So we get to see in this documentary what the world would have been like, according to these filmmakers. And again, it's satire and it's funny, but also disturbing at times when you see how things really would have ended up if the South had won.
Yeah, it's more of an experiment, I'd say. It's worth checking out.
I thought about it
for this list, but yeah, I couldn't quite crack it for me.
We do want to hear your picks after we just rattled off 35 or 40 films. Send those along with any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Ender's Game, based on Orson Scott Card's best-selling 1985 sci-fi novel. It does star Harrison Ford and Hugo's Asa Butterfield. Free Birds, this is a new film starring Owen Wilson and Woody Harrelson. They literally play a couple of turkeys who travel back in time. Yes, it is animated. And Last Vegas, De Niro, Douglas, Freeman, Kevin Kline. We really don't need to say any more, do we?
Oh.
It's the hangover for the...
These are the sort of commercials.
ARP set? What is it?
They'll actually make you feel sorry for famous millionaires when you see
point.
This play.
Out in limited release opening here in Chicago this weekend, About Time. This is the romantic comedy from the writer and director of Love Actually. A young man who realizes or learns that he can travel back in time. Domhnall Gleeson, the actor many people know from the Harry Potter movies. He played Bill Weasley, but I also loved his performance in Anna Karenina from last year. He's the star along with Rachel McAdams and Bill Nye. And I have a feeling, Josh, that as much as I want to not like this movie, it sort of seems like Love Actually, in seeing the trailer, that it's going to be kind of irresistible.
There is a lot of good talent involved. I'll
say
that about it.
A lot of good talent. Yeah, indeed. Diana, this is the film starring my favorite actress, Naomi Watts, as Princess Diana. It's a film about the last 2 years of her life. And finally, Kill Your Darlings, a murder draws together the beat poets. Are they like detectives?
I think that's what it is.
Is this like an SNL skit? You get Allen Ginsberg and Ben Foster as William Burroughs, Dane DeHaan as Lucien Carr. I'm not the biggest Daniel Radcliffe fan in the world, but I do love Ben Foster and Dane DeHaan. So maybe those two actors alone will bring me to Kill Your Darlings.
All right, you have to pick. Do you want to see Free Birds, the animated Owen Wilson thing?
Okay.
Or Last Vegas, the Morgan Freeman, Michael Douglas thing? You've got to see one. Which is it going to be?
Death is not an option.
No.
I'm going hands down Free Birds.
Yeah?
Yeah, without a doubt. Wouldn't you?
Probably.
At least you can take the kids to see that animated film, right?
Yep.
Also opening in limited release, Blue is the Warmest Color. It is the ever more controversial film that won the Palme d'Or at the last Cannes Film Festival. It's directed by Abdelatif Kashish and features two performances that won a ton of praise at Cannes and continue to earn praise. That's the movie we are planning on discussing next week on the show.
Can I just go see it and talk about the movie, or do I have to back research all of the controversy as well?
It's funny you should ask that, because I'm sure you saw it, or maybe you didn't because you were traveling, that was the IndieWire survey question this week about how much should a critic bring the controversy into their review or not bring it into the review? How much should they know? Do you want to know? That was something I did weigh in on that survey. We'll link to it in the show notes.
But sounds good.
It may come up. We'll have to see whether or not that proves to be a factor in our review of Blue is the Warmest Color next week. And also, tying in with that, we're going to share our top five sexual awakening movies.
Get excited.
How much fun does that sound?
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For our featured music this week, we play the songs of the late, great Lou Reed. You can find out more at loureed.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.